Welcome back, everyone, for another deep dive. This time, we're taking a trip to the Champagne region.
Ooh, sounds bubbly.
It is. We're going to be looking at Moët and Chandon. I think pretty much everyone has heard of them.
I think so,
But
yeah.
we're going to go, just beyond just the name everyone knows, and really kind of dig into their history.
Yeah, like how do they get so big?
Exactly. Yeah. Like, how did they get so big? How did they become like this global champagne empire? And we're going to be doing that by going through some excerpts from the Help Drachen Wein podcast, Deep Dive Edition. So that's our source material today. And I think one of those interesting things about Moët and Chandon is how their story is kind of intertwined with the story of Napoleon Bonaparte.
Wow, Napoleon, really?
Yeah. Did you know he was a big fan of their champagne?
I did not actually. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, it is. And it actually played a big role in making them popular, especially like all across Europe. Like, when you think about it, that's some pretty good marketing right.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, if Napoleon's drinking your champagne, you must be doing something right.
Right. So, we think of influencers today, but Napoleon was kind of like an OG influencer back in the
The
day.
original influencer.
Right. But let's rewind a bit. Even before Napoleon came along, Moët and Chandon had some pretty humble beginnings.
Yeah, I mean, most big companies do, right?
Yeah, they do. So where did it all start?
Okay, so picture this. 1743, we've got Claude Moët, just a regular wine merchant,
Okay.
and he starts exporting his wines from the Champagne region to Paris,
Ah,
the
passion.
big city. And that's actually how the region started getting known for, what we call champagne.
Okay, so we've got this wine exporter and he's making his way in Paris. What happens next?
Okay, so this is where things get like juicy. Claude's grandson, Jean-Rémy Moët, takes over the business, and this guy, he's got like vision, big ambition.
Okay, ambitious grandson. I like it.
Right. He ends up buying the former Hauteville Abbey in 1794.
Okay. I'm going to be honest. I don't really see the connection. Why an abbey?
You see, this wasn't just any abbey.
Oh.
This was where Dom Pérignon, the legendary Benedictine monk. This is where he was.
I've heard of Dom Pérignon.
Right. He basically refined like a lot of the techniques that we still use for making champagne.
Oh, well. So Jean-Rémy bought the place where champagne making techniques were like perfected. That's pretty smart.
Exactly. Talk about a strategic purchase.
Yeah, he's got the place, he's got the history, the techniques. What does he do with it?
Well, he was a brilliant businessman.
Yeah.
He takes all that and he really starts expanding the brand internationally,
Internationally, like where?
all over Europe,
You
even to the United States.
Wow, the United States, all the way back then.
Yeah. And then, of course, there's the whole Napoleon connection.
Oh, right. Napoleon. Their friendship it's almost legendary at this point.
It is. Napoleon loved Moët Champagne. And he wasn't exactly shy about it either, was he?
No, he wasn't.
His soldiers, they celebrated all their victories with Moët.
So basically, Napoleon turned Moët into like the drink of victory.
Pretty much. I mean, what better marketing could you ask for?
It really is like the original influencer campaign.
Totally. And that connection with Napoleon, it really stuck. It made Moët Champagne the drink for like any celebration.
So it wasn't just about victory. It was about like celebrating anything.
Yeah. They even became suppliers to, get this, the royal courts
The royal
of
courts.
Austria and England.
Wow, that's pretty high class.
It is. I mean, if the royals are drinking your champagne, you've made it, right?
Yeah, they've definitely made it. Okay, so what came next?
Well, in 1833, the company officially became Moët and Chandon. Jean-Rémy brought in his son, Victor Moët, and his son-in-law, Pierre-Gabriel Chandon de Briaille.
Oh, wow. So it became a real family business.
Yeah, a true family affair.
Did they keep like expanding the business? I mean, they were already international, right?
Oh, yeah, they kept going. The 19th century was a big time for them. That's when they started doing things that really changed the champagne industry. Like in 1842, they started releasing vintage champagnes.
Vintage champagne. So for people like me who aren't, champagne experts, what makes a vintage champagne special?
Okay, so most champagnes, right, they're blends of grapes from different years.
Okay.
It helps them keep a consistent taste. But vintage champagnes, they're made only with grapes from a single year. And not just any year, it has to be an exceptional year.
Oh, so it's like a snapshot of that year's harvest.
Exactly. You're capturing the essence of that particular year.
That makes sense. So it's all about like the quality of the grapes from that one year.
Yeah. And it became a big deal, like a marker of quality and exclusivity. And of course, Moët & Chandon, they were leading the way with this whole trend.
They do seem to be good at that, being at the forefront of trends.
Right. And then in the 1860s, they introduce Brut Imperial.
Brut Imperial, I've heard of that.
Yeah, it's their bestseller. It's still super popular today.
Why do you think it became so popular?
Well, I think they really hit that sweet spot. Not too sweet, not too dry, just the right amount of fruity flavor. It appeals to a lot of different people.
It's like a crowd pleaser.
Totally. And it really set the style for like what people think of when they think of Moët and Chandon.
Oh, that's interesting. So they weren't just making champagne, they were like shaping people's tastes.
Yeah, I think so. But they didn't stop there. In 1879, they went and bought more vineyards, this time in the Marne Valley.
I mean, more vineyards, more grapes, more champagne, right? Seems pretty straightforward.
Well, it was more than just that. See, the Marne Valley, it was known for having grapes with like very specific flavors.
Oh, so they were after something specific.
Yeah, it was about adding a new dimension to their blends, you know, making things more complex, more interesting.
Oh, that's a really good way to put it. Like they were expanding their flavor palette.
Exactly. They were playing the long game,
Yeah.
diversifying, you know. It paved the way for them to make even more types of champagne.
So, vintage champagne, they have a bestseller, they're expanding into new regions, adding new flavors. What could possibly shake things up next?
Believe it or not, the turn of the century brings a whole conflict. It was actually called the Champagne
A
War.
champagne war. Now that sounds serious.
It was all about protecting the name Champagne.
Oh, so it was like a legal battle.
Basically. See, there were other winemakers who were trying to call their sparkling wines champagne, even though they weren't from the Champagne region.
Oh, so it was like a battle over authenticity.
Exactly. The real champagne houses, like Moët and Chandon, they fought hard to protect their region's name.
Well, yeah, I mean, they built their whole reputation on it, right?
Right. It was a big
Yeah.
deal for them. And it established something really important, the idea of terroir.
Terroir, what's that?
It's the idea that true champagne can only come from the Champagne region.
Oh, so it's like it's about the place, the environment where the grapes are grown.
Yeah, it's the whole package, the soil, the climate, everything. And Moët and Chandon played a big role in making sure that idea
So
stuck.
they literally went to war for their champagne. I'm starting to see why they're so successful. What happened next?
Well, this is where they really start to become a powerhouse in the luxury market. But that, my friend, is a story for part two of our deep
Oh,
dive.
you've got to be kidding me. All right, well, we'll have to leave it there for now. Make sure to tune in for part two, where we'll uncover how Moët and Chandon became the luxury giant we know today.
You won't want to miss it.
Okay, so last time we left off with Moët and Chandon entering the 20th century.
Yeah, becoming a real player in that luxury
A
market.
real player.
Yeah.
And you mentioned that like a lot of businesses at that time, they started acquiring other brands.
They did. It was like a big strategy back then, right?
Right.
Grow by bringing other companies into the fold. And they went after some big names. So 1963, they acquired Rouen Art.
Ruin art.
Then in
Wow.
1970, Mercier.
Mercier.
And get this, the same year they merge with Hennessy.
Hennessy, the cognac people.
Exactly.
Wow, so they were really building like this whole portfolio of high-end drinks.
They were. It was about solidifying their spot in that luxury market, right?
Right.
Expanding their reach, becoming more influential, you know, adding that extra layer of prestige.
It's really smart when you think about it.
Right. And then, of course, comes the big one.
Yeah, LVMH. Everyone knows that name.
1987, Louis Vuitton Moët Hennessy, LVMH, is born.
A true luxury giant.
It was a huge deal. They brought together so many big names in luxury. Veuve Clicquot joined the group too.
Veuve Clicquot, okay.
And then a bit later, late 1990s, they acquired Krug.
Krug, wow. So from champagne to like this massive luxury conglomerate. I mean, it's kind of mind-blowing.
It is. They really had a vision, you know? They understood the power of luxury branding, building those strategic partnerships, creating a whole world of products that people want.
It's like they weren't just selling champagne anymore. They were selling like an idea.
You know, an idea, a lifestyle, and it changed the whole luxury goods industry. You know, they brought fashion and beverages together, even hospitality. I mean, they really shaped the way we think about luxury today.
It's amazing how far they came from those early days of just, exporting wine.
Right.
Okay, but let's bring it back to champagne for a second.
Sure.
We've talked about their history, but they're producing millions of bottles a year now, right?
Oh, yeah.
How does that even work within LVMH? They've got all these other champagne houses now.
It's like a big champagne family, right? Each brand kind of has its own personality, its own production level.
Right.
So Moët and Chandon, we've said it, they're making a ton, around 62 million bottles a year.
Wow.
Then you've got Veuve Clicquot, you know, the yellow label. They're doing about 20 million bottles annually. So that's a lot, right?
Yeah, a lot of bubbly.
But then you've got Krug. Krug's known for like super small scale production, really prestigious stuff.
Okay.
Only about 500,000 bottles a year.
Still a lot.
Yeah. Then you've got Ruinart, another historic house, about 2.5 million bottles.
Okay.
And Mercier, they're big in France, around 6 million bottles a year.
So even the smaller brands are making millions of bottles.
Yeah.
It kind of makes you wonder, if they're making so much champagne across all these brands, can it really still be considered a luxury good?
That's a great question. And I think it's something that the whole luxury industry is thinking about, you know?
Yeah.
On the one hand, making more champagne makes it available to more people, right? I mean, that's a good thing.
Sure. Yeah.
You can find a bottle of Moët pretty much anywhere these days.
That's true.
But then some people say that making so much of it actually like hurts the image of exclusivity.
So it's kind of a balancing act, right?
Exactly. How do you make something available but still keep it feeling special?
And I guess Moët and Chandon, they're kind of masters at this, right?
I think so. I mean, they've basically redefined what luxury is.
In what way?
Well, their champagnes are still seen as high quality, right? You know, something you'd have for a celebration.
Yeah.
But now more people can enjoy them.
They've kind of made it more democratic.
Totally. You see Moët everywhere now. Fancy restaurants, casual get-togethers. It's everywhere.
So it's like they've made it aspirational, but also accessible.
Yeah. And their success shows that people want that. You know, it's not just about exclusivity anymore. It's about having access to something special.
So how do they do that? How do they maintain that luxury image while marketing to like a bigger audience?
They're really good at marketing. Think about their ads. Celebrities sponsoring big events, always connecting themselves with celebrations, achievements.
Yeah.
They've created this idea that Moët is the perfect way to mark any occasion.
Yeah, big or small, right.
Exactly. It's not just about the product. It's about the experience, the feeling.
And they're selling that feeling really well.
They are. They get that we want to celebrate, you know, make those everyday moments a bit more special. And they've made champagne synonymous with that feeling.
Okay, so we've talked about marketing, but let's get back to the champagne itself for a minute.
Sure.
We talked about Grand Cru and Premier Cru vineyards earlier. Can you explain what those are?
They're a bit intimidating sounding, I know.
They are.
But they're basically just a ranking system in the Champagne region for vineyards.
Okay.
So Grand Cru is the top. The best.
The best of the best.
Yeah. It means great growth. So the grapes from those vineyards are supposed to be the highest quality.
So the Grand Cru vineyards are like the VIP section of Champagne.
Exactly. Perfect soil, perfect climate. Everything's perfect for growing grapes.
Wow.
Then you've got Premier Cru, just below Grand Cru, but still very high quality.
Okay.
And Moët and Chandon, they own a lot of those top tier vineyards.
Really? Like how much?
About 50% of Grand Cru vineyards.
Wow.
And 25% of Premier Cru.
That's a huge amount.
It is. It means they have a lot of control over the quality of their grapes.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
If you've got the best ingredients, you can make the best champagne.
Right. But they don't just use their own vineyards. They also get grapes from other growers in the region.
Oh, so they're kind of mixing and matching.
Yeah. It gives them more flexibility with their blends.
That's really interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. What about their cellars? I remember saying they're massive.
Oh, yeah. They're legendary. 28 kilometers of cellars under the city of Epernay.
That's huge.
The biggest in Champagne. And they actually have street names down there. It's like a whole underground save, but for champagne.
And the cellars, they're not just for storage, right? They're important for the actual champagne making process.
They are. That's where the magic happens. The cool human environment is perfect for the second fermentation.
That's the one that gives champagne its bubbles, right?
Exactly. And that's where the champagne ages, develops all those complex flavors.
The cellars are like this giant aging chamber.
Yeah. Think of it like a fine wine maturing in a perfectly controlled environment.
And Moët and Chandon has the biggest ones in the region. Pretty impressive.
It is. But they're also not afraid to, you know, innovate.
Oh, in what way?
Well, their newest winery, it's in Montague near Epernay.
Okay.
It's totally state-of-the-art, designed to be super efficient, environmentally friendly.
So they're blending like their centuries-old traditions with modern technology.
Exactly. They're always trying to find ways to make things better.
But without sacrificing quality.
Right. They get that to stay on top, you have to keep innovating. It's that blend of tradition and innovation that makes them so unique.
So we've talked about their vineyards, the cellars, their production. We even touched on marketing. I feel like I'm really starting to understand the scale of their operation.
It is massive. But we still haven't talked about one key part.
Oh, and what's that?
Dom Perignon, their prestige champagne brand. Named after, you know, the monk we talked about before.
Oh, right. Dom Perignon. I think everyone has at least heard the name, right?
Pretty much. It's like the ultimate champagne experience.
What makes it so special?
It's in a different league. It's considered one of the finest champagnes in the world. They use Chardonnay and Pinot Noir grapes, and they only make it in exceptional vintage years.
Oh, so it's not even made every year.
No. Only when the harvest is really good.
So it's got to be, like, the perfect conditions.
Yeah, the best of the best. And then, even within Dom Perignon, they have different levels. There's a special variation called Enotech.
Okay.
That one's aged for much longer.
So it's like an even more special version of an already special champagne.
Yeah. Good things come to those who wait, right?
Right. But we've been talking about Moët and Chandon's massive production, millions of bottles. What about Dom Perignon? Is that made on a smaller scale?
Well, it is, but here's the thing. Even with that selective production, you know, the long aging, they still make a lot of it.
Really? Like how much?
We're talking 1 to 2 million bottles, maybe even more.
Wow, that's way more than I expected. So they're still kind of doing that balancing act, right?
Yeah.
Trying to be exclusive, but also making enough to meet demand.
Exactly. It makes you think, how do they keep that image of prestige when they're making that much?
Yeah. What does that say about how we see luxury these days?
That's a good question. But before we get too deep into that, I think we need to talk about how Moët and Chandon even got the rights to the Dom Perignon name in the first place.
Oh, yeah. That's a whole other story.
It is.
Okay, let's hear it. How did they end up with this iconic champagne name? Okay, so last time we were talking about how Moët and Chandon got the rights to the Dom Perignon name.
Right. It's actually a pretty interesting story.
Well, don't leave us in suspense. How did they get it?
So it all goes back to 1930.
Okay.
They acquired the rights from the house Mercier. Okay. But here's the thing. Mercier never actually used the name for their own champagne.
Really? So why would they buy the rights if Mercier wasn't even using it?
Well, there was this Englishman, Lawrence Venn. He had this idea, this vision for a truly prestige cuvee, something really special. And he thought Dom Perignon, that name, that was perfect for it.
So they basically took a name that was just sitting there and turned it into like this champagne icon.
Yeah, pretty much. They saw the potential and they went for it. And, you know, they weren't.
Verse Dom Perignon Champagne, when was that released?
1936.
Okay.
And get this, it was made with grapes from the 1921 vintage.
Wow, so it was like a late bloomer.
It was, but it really paid off for them. It helped shape the whole champagne market.
How so?
Well, it showed that people were ready for these like super premium champagnes, and it elevated the whole image of champagne, you know, made it even more special.
And we've talked about how good Moët and Chandon is at marketing, but how did Dom Perignon, how did it become such a part of pop culture?
It's a few things, I think. First, the name itself, Dom Perignon the monk. He's almost like a legend in the champagne world.
Mm. It's like they're borrowing that legendary status.
Exactly. And then, of course, there's the quality. It's always getting great reviews. It's served at all these fancy events.
It's the champagne for celebrations.
And it is. And let's not forget about Hollywood.
Oh, right. James Bond. Goldfinger.
That one line. Man drinks Dom Perignon 53 above a temperature of 38 degrees Fahrenheit. That's just as bad as listening to the Beatles without earmuffs.
Classic. I think everyone remembers that line.
Right. And suddenly Dom Perignon isn't just champagne. It's like this cultural symbol.
Sophistication, style, a little bit of danger.
Yeah. And then all the other pop culture references. I mean, Wappers, singers, everyone's name dropping it.
It's everywhere.
They've managed to go beyond just champagne. They've become like a symbol of success.
It's true. Okay. So I think we've covered a lot of ground here. From Napoleon to James Bond. It's been quite a journey with Moët and Chandon.
It has. From those humble beginnings to this global empire, they've really done it all.
And it leaves us with some interesting questions to think about.
Like what does luxury even mean these days? If a brand can make millions of bottles of champagne and still be seen as exclusive.
Is it about the price, the quality, the story behind the brand?
I think it's a bit of everything. But Moët and Chandon, they really understand how to connect with people on an emotional level.
They get that we want to celebrate, we want to treat ourselves.
Yeah. And they've made luxury feel, you know, attainable.
Even if it's just for a little while.
Right. It's been a fascinating depth dive, really.
It has. Anything else you'd like to add before we wrap things up?
Just this.
Yeah.
The next time you see a bottle of Moët and Chandon, take a moment to think about the story.
The ambition, the innovation.
Centuries of tradition. There's a bit of magic in every bottle.
Very well said. It's more than just a drink, isn't it?
It is. It's a piece of history, a celebration, a reminder to enjoy the good things in life.
Absolutely. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive into the world of Moët and Chandon. We'll see you next time for another deep dive into the world of wine and spirits.
Cheers to that.